When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get a top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning, this is Bennett Kelly, and welcome to another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report. We are broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center here in downtown Santa Monica in the heart of Silicon Beach. Follow us at internetlawcenter.net. We are thrilled to have an old friend of the show back today, Matt Schaefer of Brandon Isaacson in Lewiston, Maine, although he's calling in from the Portland office. Matt is one of the nation's leading lawyers dealing with online sales taxes, is one of our earliest episodes in February 2011, and won a major victory within hours of getting off the air. And the next week, we had a guest discussing the role of the internet in Arab Spring, and Egyptian President Mubarak resigned days after that show. So the next episode, I invited the Boston Red Sox to come on while we still had our mojo. And they should have taken our advice, since that was the year that the Red Sox had a record September collapse. So Matt is back, but the Red Sox are safely in the playoffs. So and he's here to talk about a recent Supreme Court decision that may open up the door to states imposing online sales taxes, South Dakota versus Wayfair, a case he was co-counsel in. So you can check out our show notes for background on Matt and this topic at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com and follow us on Twitter at cyberlawradio. Matt, thank you for joining us.
Ben, it's great to talk with you again.
It's been a while, but it's good to have you back. And so this whole journey of getting the Wayfair battle, it actually covers, kind of takes a detour through much of what we were talking about several years ago with the Amazon tax. But why don't you just start us off with, you know, how we got here, you know, from Quill to now Wayfair.
Sure. So you mentioned Quill. Quill was a case the court decided in 1992, Supreme Court of the United States, in 1992 reaffirmed a 1967 rule that is adopted in a case called National Bellis Hess, which provided that in order for a state to be able to force a business to collect that state's sales taxes, that the business needed to have a physical presence in the state. And in the earlier cases, Bellis Hess and Quill, that was about mail order retailers. Post-1992, we all know what happened. The internet took off, and the issue gained even more prominence because internet retail, took over the major segment of growth in the U.S. economy on the retail segment. So you ended up with a question about, well, this physical presence rule from Bellis Hess and Quill, what's the right understanding of that in the internet era? And fast forward to the sort of kind of early 2000s, states began to get very aggressive about trying to force internet retailers to collect their sales taxes, and they adopted a variety of different laws seeking to do that.
One of the things just to interrupt, yeah, we that's what we had you had on to talk about. Basically, I was calling it the Amazon tax wars, and you had this boom of the internet occurring right at the time of the collapse of the economy, and state revenues were plummeting, and they're looking at all these online sales that were going untaxed. So they kind of contorted to define Nexus to fit within the Quill confines, and that's what started that we kind of this battle but continue, please.
Yeah, so you're right. It was 2008 when New York, right in the middle of that financial crisis, said, "Why don't we see if we can't get retailers to collect our taxes based on them having internet affiliates in the state?" News sites or other sites where they had an ad and they would get referrals from that news site to customers who might make a purchase. New York sought to use that as a way of requiring retailers to collect tax. It was largely successful, but some of the other states, including Illinois, that adopted it didn't have as much luck. We won a case in Illinois. That's the one you're referring to back in 2013, the Illinois Supreme Court. But states certainly weren't going to give up the effort. There was a Colorado law that was enacted around 2010 that my firm litigated for years and years, including up to the Supreme Court on a jurisdictional issue that sought to make retailers collect under a different mechanism. And then in 2016, South Dakota said, we're going to just take this head on and we're going to adopt a statute that requires a retailer that does not have physical presence in the state to collect our taxes if it has enough sales or transactions in the state. So
they clearly were intending to create a challenge to Quill.
Yes, that was the entire point of the law.
Now, what surprised me in terms of how we got here was, there was a challenge to the New York, the first law, the first Amazon tax law, and it was upheld by the New York High Court, and there was an appeal to the Supreme Court, and I was surprised that they didn't bite. In 2013.
Yeah, marked the history of Supreme Court attention to this issue was largely turning down cases, not taking them.
Exactly. And then you have 2015, that where you actually, your firm is before the Supreme Court in Direct Marketing Association versus Broll, and the opinion itself is just reversing a Court of Appeals decision that said that you couldn't enjoin a state from enforcing a law because you couldn't. It was this kind of technical issue about whether you couldn't a federal court could enjoin state tax collection, and Justice Thomas said no, that's not the issue. But you had this remarkable concurrence by Justice Kennedy, who says it is unwise to delay any longer a reconsideration of the court's holding in Quill. And I guess South Dakota's law was passed right the next year, right?
It was, and they pointed to Justice Kennedy's concurrence in that Broll case of ours, where they said, this is something that even Justice of the Supreme Court is suggesting we ought to revisit, and the legislature in South Dakota made reference to.
So let's talk a little bit about the policy issue here. Basically the states are saying, everyone was pointing at Amazon, so that's why it was called the Amazon tax. Although, eventually the Amazon tax wars became about everyone other than Amazon, since Amazon eventually had physical presence in all 50 states, or at least agreed to pay taxes in all 50. But
that's absolutely right.
You have states pointing to the amount of revenue they were losing from not being able to collect for interstate transactions where the retailer wasn't based in their home state. What was the magnitude of what they were saying be left on the table?
So the states had an expert that had calculated a number that was really, from our point of view, excessive. But they were talking about, come 2017, something on the order of $34 billion a year that states were not collecting on internet sales. Now, as it happened, the Governmental Accountability Office issued a study of internet sales taxes right at the end of 2017, just as the court was about to take up our Wayfair case, and it found that the actual number was more like between $8 and $13 billion a year. So still a lot of money, but much smaller than what the states have been claiming, and honestly the trend was in the other direction. states were starting to collect on more and more online sales, Amazon leading the way, starting to collect all over the country, but other large retailers doing the same thing.
Now, there's a weird nuance in this, in that while, and maybe, I'm not sure this is just California, but while in a transaction in which, you know, the interstate, the retailer is out of state, and so therefore has no duty to collect sales tax, depending on the state, you may still have a duty to pay the tax, and California is one of those states. And I actually was audited for my online sales, and had to, you know, give a report and, you know, produce records for my online purchases for a couple of years, and I owed like $8.50 or something something really ridiculous. And to think of the administrative time and expense on both ends, from the government to my end, to really right the ship of California's fiscal state over $8.50.
Yeah, it's striking. The, you know, you and I, we both live in sales tax states. We, you know, theoretically, when you're a resident of a state and you make a purchase from an out-of-state company, you are obligated to pay that tax even if the company hasn't collected it from you. The challenge that makes both the kind of administrative ridiculousness of what you just described, but also the problem for remote sellers, is there are, you know, while there are 45 states plus the District of Columbia that can collect sales taxes, there are more than 10,000 local jurisdictions in the United States that also have sales taxes. So internet retailers, particularly smaller businesses, who are confronted with an obligation potentially to collect tax in every jurisdiction that assesses a sales tax, it's a really daunting challenge for them. And that was really at the core of the Wayfair case.
So Wayfair comes to the Supreme Court, and I have to ask you a lawyer-to-lawyer question. What's it like walking into the Supreme Court as a litigant, not to sit in the gallery, but when you're actually, you know, you're in the front?
Well, if you're an appellate lawyer, it's the, you know, the pinnacle of your career. And, you know, I think that we've been to the court, fortunate to go on two occasions in the last, you know, 5 years, and it's, you know, really an honor and a lot of fun, to be honest.
And then, so you get there for the either Brohl or Wayfair. Were there any memorable points from the arguments? Like any justice any personality that stayed with you?
Yeah, I think thinking about Wayfair, because it's the more recent one. We went into that argument knowing that the court had, what had happened below was the courts in the state of South Dakota had agreed with us because the Quill precedent required that. And so we went in to the United States Supreme Court knowing that the court had taken the case, a case where it could have passed and the rule would have stayed the same, which said, right, well, you know, the court's going to think about whether or not to reverse, which ultimately it did by a 5-4 vote. But you go in knowing that that may be the predisposition of the court. And in our case, we had some justices. We can talk more about this maybe, but three of the justices were really, you know, not likely to favor us. So.
And which three?
It was daunting. Well, you had Justice Kennedy
who basically gave them the invite, yeah.
Right. You had Justice Thomas, doesn't like the Dormant Commerce Clause.
Yeah.
And he said he will never again strike down a state law on that basis. And you had Justice Gorsuch, who we had actually been before twice on in our Brohl case when it was in the Tenth Circuit, and we knew that he was not a fan either. So, you know, we needed really to get five of the other six to win the case. And so it was a little bit daunting coming in, and I think most of the industry and most of the state tax world thought the court will certainly reverse. Why else did it take the case?
Right.
And what was really interesting is right out of the box, Justice Sotomayor came after the state's attorney general who was arguing the case for the state with a series of really hard questions. And I'd like to say she came out swinging, which was interesting because she had slipped in her kitchen.
She was in the cast.
That's right, and I think she had broken her shoulder.
So yeah.
You know, there was a chance she wouldn't even come, but she came to the argument and came right out after him. And that, it really set a tone that was interesting. Going into the argument, everyone thought, we are certain to lose the case, you know, on the retailer side, and coming out, everyone said, wow, this is really a toss-up. And as it happened, it did end up being a 5-4 decision, just went against us.
And anything from the other than Sotomayor, anything else stand out from the arguments?
Well, I was gratified that Justice Breyer, in expressing some views about the case, said, you know, he said this to the state's attorney general, I read your briefs and I thought, absolutely right. And then I read their briefs and I thought, absolutely right. And you can't both be absolutely right. Now, I feel a little bit like being told that, my brief was, you know, that convincing is a little bit, you know, now that given the outcome, a little bit like being told your hair looks good just before your head gets cut off. But but it was still gratifying to, you know, have Justice Breyer point to our arguments and say, you know, you convinced me, but the difficulty here is I have to come up with a way of breaking this deadlock.
So that's
siding with us, incidentally.
Well, that's good. I was going to say, was that the legal equivalent of saying it's not you, it's me?
Right.
So
he was one of the four dissenters.
So let's talk about why Justice Kennedy and the majority decided, okay, we have to overrule Quill.
Sure. So Quill was a physical presence rule, right? Which the court felt had, the 5-justice majority, really no redeeming qualities, to be honest. Justice Kennedy felt that the rule was incorrect when it was decided, that it was an unsound interpretation of the Commerce Clause, that it favored remote sellers over in-state businesses in a way that tilted the playing field, that it created economic distortions in the marketplace. If you have a single employee in a state, you have to collect tax, but if you are selling millions of dollars into the state from a remote location, you don't. He really found nothing to justify the rule, and on that grounds thought that it was appropriate to overturn it despite its value as settled precedent. And that was the problem he had. The other side was, you know, really much more focused, as we were, on the value of the precedent.
Right. And I mean, I lifted a quote in the show notes, and he said the Commerce Clause must not prefer interstate commerce only to the point where a merchant physically crosses state borders. Rejecting the physical presence rule is necessary to ensure that artificial competitive advantages are not created by this court's precedents.
That's exactly right. They really felt that the Quill rule was distorting the marketplace. That was the view of the majority. I think there's a good counter argument to that, and some of the show notes you quote from Justice Roberts point out, you know, one of the basis that, you know, that those are the rules under which this entire marketplace has grown up.
Right.
And to change that rule so abruptly, and what really is a policy judgment appropriate to Congress more than it is to the court, is, you know, is going to create incredible uncertainty in the marketplace. And to be frank, there is a substantial uncertainty right now about compliance with state tax laws.
Yeah, Justice Roberts says the court should not act on this important question of economic policy solely to expiate a mistake it made over 50 years ago. And this is something that should be undertaken by Congress. And I can see the argument.
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution gives Congress the authority to regulate interstate commerce, and that's, you know, one of the reasons why the court had reaffirmed the rule in Quill 25 years before. Congress really is the body with the expertise to be able to analyze the competing interests and understand how this might impact the market, and also to implement measures to limit those kinds of negative effects. The court really isn't, you know, an up or down kind of a vote on the current rule, and it can't, you know, implement fine distinctions that can take care of the kinds of complexities that multi-state tax compliance imposes.
And Congress, you know, had attempted to address this through debates over what was known as the Main Street Marketplace Fairness legislation, and but you know, that seemed to never get anywhere because, you know, Congress just can't seem to agree on anything that involves a tax.
Right. Well, that's the great debate, right? Congress was not inactive in the area. They had, in fact, looked at lots of solutions, and none had ever garnered a majority of both houses. So, you know, does that mean that Congress is paralyzed? You know, unfortunately, we see that a lot in many areas nowadays. Or does it mean that they think the current rule is better than the alternatives that have been put forward so far? And the reality is, state taxes are complex. You know, Chief Justice Roberts, in his dissent, pointed it out. I'm going to read for just a second from him. He said, sure. The court breezily disregards the costs that its decisions will impose on retailers. Correctly calculating and remitting sales tax on all e-commerce sales will likely prove baffling for many retailers. Over 10,000 jurisdictions levy sales taxes, each with different tax rates, different rules governing tax-exempt goods and services, different product category definitions, and different standards for determining whether you're subject to the tax. And that complexity is something that Congress had yet to, I think, find what it viewed to be an adequate solution for. And the backstop rule of the physical presence standard was something that you might, as Justice Kennedy did, say this doesn't make sense in a lot of circumstances, kind of at the margins. But it did create a rule that limited the complexity of state tax compliance for multi-state businesses. And that limitation is now gone, and businesses are having to deal with that. There are new limiting principles from the court's Wayfair decision, but we're in a transition period.
So we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk about really the fallout from the Wayfair decision and what exactly comes next. After these messages, you're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
It's time once again to get ready for the 35th Annual Miami Book Fair, November 11th through the 18th. Learn more at MiamiBookFair.com. Over 500 authors will be coming in from all over the world to read their books, answer questions from the audience, and sign autographs. Award-winning luminaries confirmed to attend this year include novelists like Elliot Ackerman, Robert Olin Butler, Ingrid Rojas Contreras, and Deborah Dean. Nonfiction writers like Dr. Mark Agronin, Muhammad Al-Samawi, Andrea Barnett, and Tina Brown. Celebrities like Justine Bateman, Steve Kornacki, Bill Press. These are just a few of the confirmed 500 authors scheduled to appear at the 2018 Miami Book Fair, November 11th to the 18th. Check out the full schedule of events right now at MiamiBookFair.com. That's MiamiBookFair.com.
There are over 70 million active podcast listeners in the U.S. WebmasterRadio.fm reaches them all with the largest global distribution of any online business-to-business podcast network. Through iHeartRadio, iTunes, Stitcher, and the WebmasterRadio.fm mobile app, we can target and place your message in front of those active listeners immediately. Now, your message can be delivered with less commitment and investment on over 20 hours of weekly original content hosted by the most respected names in digital marketing, thanks to an exclusive private offer available for a very limited number of companies. But you must act fast. Email brasco@wmr.fm and get your message delivered now.
Cyberspace, the final frontier. These are the voyages of your new business enterprise. Its ongoing mission to explore strange new domains, to seek out new sites and new monetizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before. WebmasterRadio.fm. So logical. You'll go out of your Vulcan mind.
WebmasterRadio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back. A few announcements of upcoming events of note. At noon Pacific today, the California Lawyers Association's Technology, Internet, and Privacy Subcommittee, which I chair, will be holding their monthly call with a presentation on the status of net neutrality from the EFF. And tomorrow and Friday, the Federal Trade Commission will begin a series of hearings at my alma mater, Georgetown University Law Center, on whether broad-based changes in the economy, evolving business practices, new technology, or international developments might require adjustments to competition and consumer protection enforcement law, enforcement priorities, and policy. The hearings will be webcast, so we have information both are available in our show notes at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com. So before the break, we were talking about what now. And I guess let's talk about let's stay within the Wayfair confines. Is that case resolved now?
The case was remanded by the United States Supreme Court back to the South Dakota state courts. And there's not been much activity upon remand, other than it's been sent all the way back to the trial court. The parties were discussing whether or not there was a way to resolve the matter, and they haven't reached an agreement in that regard, which triggered some action by the governor of South Dakota. So here's where things stood with the case being accepted by the United States Supreme Court. There were a handful of states that had copied South Dakota, and there have been lawsuits filed in those states. And those state statutes were all suspended pending the outcome of the Wayfair case. Along with South Dakota's. The statute itself in South Dakota doesn't allow the Department of Revenue to enforce the law until the case is resolved. So the remand meant that South Dakota still wasn't yet able to enforce. So the governor, impatient to be able to permit his state revenue department to start imposing sales tax on remote sales, has introduced some special legislation and bills that are going before the South Dakota legislature today, as a matter of fact, that would lift that ban effective November 1st for every company other than the three companies that were involved in the suit. And I expect that will pass, and I'm not a South Dakota lobbyist or anything, but I'll be surprised if they don't get that through. So the case isn't fully resolved. I wouldn't expect a lot of new developments in the South Dakota case itself. I think what we're going to be looking for now are developments elsewhere around the country. And, you know, again, we are really in a period of some uncertainty as states figure out what they're going to do in the wake of Wayfair.
Now, the timing of the ruling is important because it was announced as at the close of the session. You know, it was one of the final decisions announced in June, and as Justice Kennedy was announcing his retirement. And in a way, fortunately, from your perspective, the a lot of states had already concluded their legislative sessions by that point. There were only a handful that were still in session. So the really battle over at the state level in terms of what next from after Wayfair probably won't begin until January.
Well, I think I have to put an asterisk on that. And so revenue departments were still in session, right? They never adjourned. So there were a lot of revenue departments that decided to announce effective dates. So what you have now, one step back. Compliance with state tax systems across the entire country, not just in South Dakota, but everywhere, which is really the potential outcome from the Supreme Court's decision, is daunting for a lot of retailers, big and small alike. Especially, you know, smaller players probably have a bigger obstacle, but there are big players that are challenged by this as well. And they really need time, at a minimum, to be able to try to implement systems to collect taxes in dozens of states and potentially thousands of jurisdictions. Well, not every state is being patient. So there are a handful of states that have asked for companies to start collecting as of the 1st of July of 2018. And there's a wave that are coming on around October 1st. There's a few that have announced that they're going to defer that collection date until early 2019. And when you take that whole group together, there's about 30 states that have announced an effective date. You know, really anything as early as October is just not feasible for most companies. There are some that can do it, but it's really a daunting challenge for most. So we've got about 30 that have announced, about 15, including the largest states, California, New York, Texas, Florida, Pennsylvania, who have not announced a specific date yet.
I guess thank Kevin for small
for small miracles.
Yeah. I guess the question then is, one, where is Congress on all this? And I maybe we should talk a little bit about the whole effort to streamline sales tax and the Main Street Fairness Bill.
Sure. It's an important feature not only of federal legislation, but also of the court's decision for the following reason. You mentioned an attempt to streamline. So there's a organization called the Streamline Sales Tax Governing Board that is represented by states that have joined a Streamline Sales and Use Tax agreement. And that agreement requires the states to make their laws more uniform and more simplified. Now, unfortunately, the 20-some-odd states that are members of that only make up about 30% of the population. Once again, all the large states are not members. But South Dakota is one of those states. And the Supreme Court, in deciding that the physical presence rule of Quill was no longer the law, said, we now need some other standards by which to assess state laws. The court made clear that multi-state tax collection can be a burden. But it said, we do have principles in Commerce Clause jurisprudence that allow us to assess undue burden, and it pointed to some of the other tests the court has identified, but at the same time said, let's look at South Dakota. It has features of a system that we think help to eliminate undue burden on multi-state sellers. And those features are membership in the Streamline Sales and Use Tax agreement, as well as certain thresholds for, you know, small sellers. If you fall below a certain volume of sales, you're not obligated to collect. And then finally, a prohibition on retroactive enforcement. So they can't go back and say, ha, you know, the rules just changed, and now, you know, 3 years ago when you thought you didn't have to collect because of physical presence, well, guess what? That's no longer a good rule, so now we're going to come back and go after you. So South Dakota prohibits that. Those three features, SSUTA membership, thresholds, and non-retroactivity, are the sort of wayfair factors that you can point to for how do we evaluate whether or not a state law is consistent with the Constitution. Streamlining is something that Congress has looked at as well, so it really has become a major focus now of going forward compliance.
Now, if I remember right, there seemed to be momentum for what was being called the Marketplace Fairness Act that would allow states to collect. It basically would give a, you know, give South Dakota and others what they wanted and what they got out of Wayfair, so long as they did so in this kind of compact of you know, streamlining sales tax so that it was understandable. And it got a fair amount of support, but then got the veto from the anti-tax advocates, who said that, you know, even though it wasn't necessarily raising taxes, since it was permitting collection of taxes that aren't currently being collected, it therefore was anathema to their anti-tax ideology. And that kind of just killed the bill's progress.
Yeah, it's been the case that folks that are generally opposed to more taxes have opposed the effort of states to be able to expand their sales tax collection systems to remote sales. There have also been advocates within the Congress and elsewhere that have felt like there's a feature of taxation without representation to remote sales tax collection. So if you're a retailer in Indiana and
right.
you're making a sale to someone in Florida, you don't really have any voice in the Florida legislature about whether or not your products should be taxed, at what
right.
rate, you know, et cetera. And so not only are there advocates in Congress who said, you know, that smacks to us of taxation without representation, imposing that obligation on that Indiana seller, but there were some prominent Supreme Court advocates who had, you know, made similar arguments to the court in their amicus filings as well. So those factors, along with this, you know, I mentioned that, as you say, simplification with streamlining was sort of the model they were going for, and unfortunately, so many states have passed on that membership. They've said, no, we're not prepared to do that, that it hadn't gotten through Congress.
Well, maybe they need to have a better Christmas party so everyone joins. But
it would have been certainly some kind of, you know, door prize or something.
Yeah. The but here's the thing. It puts, you know, at the Washington level, it creates a big conflict. I mean, on one level, Congress could just say, you know, Kennedy was wrong. When we're ready to act, we'll act and just pass a law saying, you know, overruling Wayfair, I guess they could. And that would be, you know, kind of a win for the anti-tax people. But at the same time, many of the anti-tax people are also very much state rights, states' rights people. And you're basically, you're nullifying the states' rights to decide that they want to collect these.
It can be a tension for, you know, for advocates that value those kinds of things, and you're right. It's Congress does have the authority to change these rules, so it can change what the Supreme Court has done by enacting legislation that adjusts the rules. And really, simplification from Congress has become even more important now than it was before. And so, I think you'll continue to see a push for that. States now don't have as much interest in it because they've won what they wanted to win from the
right.
United States Supreme Court. So it's not certain by any means that we'll see a congressional solution, but it really would be the right outcome.
And so in terms of the politics of the situation, I mean, your clients are, is it fair to say, large retailers?
Yeah, we represent dozens of remote sellers of various sizes, but certainly the companies that were targeted by South Dakota, and precisely for that reason, were large businesses. Wayfair, Overstock, Newegg are larger internet retailers.
And last I checked, you guys aren't without influence in Washington.
I think, you know, we all know that bigger companies do tend to have more clout, unfortunately, when it comes to what can happen in Congress. You've gone from having a backdrop of a physical presence rule to having a backdrop of, you know, no physical presence rule, and it does change the dynamics. One of the fascinating things, as you alluded to, is that Amazon, in the course of this changing landscape, really switched sides. It had, you know, for a
yeah.
long time didn't collect taxes, and now it does. And to be honest, Amazon has benefited enormously by the court's decision. It had started collecting taxes everywhere. You know, a decision that's going to require many more companies, including its smaller competitors, to collect taxes, only helps it. It provides a lot of tax collection services, you know, for other retailers, and there'll be presumably more retailers will be interested in buying that service from Amazon. So they've been assisted by this outcome, I think, in ways that tend to, you know, we talk about the antitrust issue that's coming up before the FTC. They've been helped by this outcome in ways that improve their dominant position. But it means that the politics are nuanced to a certain extent. And if we put the politics aside and just think about the policy for a moment, the right policy would be a simpler sales tax system.
And without having to show your cards, is there any, you know, strategy, or is there anything that your clients are pushing in Washington in particular?
Well, simplification measures, many of which are similar to streamlined, but some which might go beyond that, are something that's really vital. There are industry associations, many of whom band together under a under the trust banner, sort of true simplification of state taxes, mm-hmm. that have advocated certain measures, you know, to simplify the number of audits that a company can be subjected to, the definition so they don't change from state to state what's taxable and what's not, the way different aspects of taxes are administered. The list goes on and on, honestly, in terms of the things that could be simplified and in the best outcome will be. But, you know, it's going to take more momentum. Folks on who are impacted by this, who may be listening, it makes sense to be in touch with your legislators to let your interests be known, because the more they hear that this is an issue of importance, the more likely we'll get a solution out of the Congress.
Exactly. And one thing about this retail industries is that Congress responds when there's something in usually a nationwide industry, because there's one of them in every district, you know, and that makes people wake up, you know. And the insurance agents are very powerful in Washington, because, you know, every congressman knows an insurance agent. Same for librarians and the other groups. And so, yeah, everyone knows a mom and pop store, or even, you know, a bigger store. And, you know, they buy there and they run into the people at there when they're back in the district. So definitely their voices will be heard. One voice that has to be heard, though, we have to take our last break. So we'll be back after these messages. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
The Web Marketing Association is now accepting entries for its 7th Annual International Mobile Web Award Competition. This award program is an opportunity for mobile developers to demonstrate their expertise in this growing medium. It recognizes the individual and team achievements of web professionals all over the world who create and maintain outstanding responsive and mobile websites and mobile applications. Deadline for entry is September 28, 2018. Submit your entry today at www.mobile-webaward.org. That's mobile-webaward.org.
Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be. TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. TopSEOs sends you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let TopSEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and we'll have an archive show next week, since it will be my 20th wedding anniversary. Yes, hard to believe. Do you send her an anniversary card or a sympathy card? But September 19th is also the day of the Terry Fox run. Terry Fox is a Canadian hero who lost his leg to cancer. So he tried to raise money and awareness for cancer by running across the country, a marathon each day on one leg. And he got halfway across the country until the cancer came back and was found in his lungs. And his foundation organizes a run every September 19th, years after his passing. So we have information in our show notes on the run, and I encourage you to check it out. It's a real courageous story, and so it's a worthy charity. But one thing that is not a charity are retailers, and we're talking with Matthew Schaefer about the Wayfair ruling. Now, Matt, I always love this story, and you know, Matt isn't calling from some Madison Avenue firm. He's calling from a firm that's based in Lewiston, Maine, and it's a great story how this became a legal power in the retail space.
Yeah, we were fortunate to represent the wonderful retailer L.L. Bean for a number of years, going back into the 60s when one of our former partners established a relationship with Leon Gorman, who was then the chairman of Bean. And L.L. Bean, being a prominent catalog marketer, our firm became involved in issues of importance to catalog marketers, and then from there those companies morphed into you know, internet businesses. At the same time, we were counsel to some of the associations representing those businesses, like the Direct Marketing Association that we represented in the 2015 Brohl case. And that, you know, it was that L.L. Bean nexus that allowed us to develop a client base representing internet businesses and multi-state retailers.
And we've actually had a number of people from Maine on our show. Not only is there you, there's Jane Hitchcock, who's a big cyber crime expert, and she's in New York. And we had Trevor from the IAPP, which used to be based in New York Harbor, and I think he's moved it to Portsmouth. Maine has a surprisingly prominent internet presence.
Something in our clean water, maybe. I think.
Maybe that's it. So, any event. So, let's talk about what this means for a retailer. How much does it cost to comply with the 10,000 plus taxes that you have to collect? Or are retailers just saying, sorry, if I'm only have three sales from Wyoming, I'm just not going to bother to do sales there because it's not worth the expense?
Right. I think most retailers are looking at compliance. There are some of those thresholds that protect the smallest businesses from being obligated to collect everywhere. We have to watch to see whether states are going to follow the guidance of Wayfair and adopt those kinds of thresholds that may protect the smallest businesses. But most are trying to figure out how to comply in more states. We do have rules that might now limit the authority of states who aren't members of Streamline, for example, who don't simplify their systems. It's expensive. The license fees for software are significant themselves. They usually run in the five, often six figures as you get to a bigger business. But it's really the costs that are more difficult to quantify that start to add up. And those kinds of costs are, when you buy software, you have to map all of your products onto that software to determine their taxability, which means you have to sort of categorize them and think about, is this pair of shoes, is that athletic wear, or is it clothing? This candy that I sell, is that right, properly characterized as candy, or does it have something that might make it a food product? And so you have to do this across all of your products, and that's your own effort at your own expense.
Right.
And on the back end, you have audits. That's a real concern, and one that we, of course, don't have enough time post-Wayfair to have too much experience with, but anyone who's been audited knows it's time-consuming, it's expensive, it detracts from your business, from what you really want to be doing. And if companies are now going to be subject to dozens or even hundreds of audits a year, we're going to see a real negative impact from this.
Definitely. So do you think, in terms of planning your year next year, how much of it do you think you'll be in state capitals versus how much do you think you'll be in Washington?
Well, I think at the moment it'll probably be more state capitals. If we're fortunate to see a solution out of Washington, it'll be something that I think puts some order to the chaos. But otherwise, I think it's more likely that we're going to be dealing with this on a state-by-state basis, in some instances a locality-by-locality basis. And it really, the uncertainty of it is, it may, you know, we'll see how it shakes out, but when Chief Justice Roberts says, you know, when you change the rule as a court, instead of letting Congress do it, we're not sure what's going to happen. You know, we're going to go through a period of uncertainty now that we're going to have to ride out.
Yeah, I'm reminded of, there's the 70s movie with Robert Redford, the candidate, and, you know, at the end of the movie, he wins, and it's like, okay, now what? I haven't really thought about that. We've been so focused on winning, you know, now what? And I guess, you know, we are in this great period of uncertainty.
We are. States, you know, some state tax officials speak reasonably about this and say we need to take it slow and we need to understand that this can't happen overnight. But, you know, just yesterday, for example, the state of Colorado, which has probably the most complicated state tax system in the country for sales and use taxes, has just issued emergency regulations that are going to require remote sellers to collect taxes starting December 1st.
Wow, and this is a state flush with cannabis cash.
Right, which makes you wonder why they apparently are trying to capture the holiday sales season. I don't know.
Oh, that must be it. Yeah, I was thinking, unlike 2008, where you had a recession, and, you know, it takes a while for states' tax revenue to come back from a recession. So that's why you had those Amazon battles. And, you know, unlike now, you have a decent economy, so states may not be as fiscally pressed as they were a decade ago.
Yeah, I mean, we presented evidence to the court in the case that although states were complaining about the lost revenues, state sales tax revenues across the country had actually been growing for the last several years regularly. And so they weren't really strapped for cash, and the problem, honestly, was getting smaller, not more egregious. But it may just be that, you know, by the time the legal system caught up to the marketplace, you know, there was a little bit behind the curve in terms of what the market realities were. Companies now increasingly sell through multiple channels, as I'm sure you know and your listeners know.
Right.
If you're doing that, you more often have physical presence. So
that's true. Now, maybe you guys should consider having your clients just set up a GoFundMe page for the states, and that'll just solve the problem. But we only have a few minutes left. Matt, you got an impressive background, and it's always been a pleasure having you and working with you. At least, but we've done a conference or two together. Do you have anything coming up you want to announce, or any articles or conferences you're speaking at?
Well, as it happens, I'm talking about this issue, as you might imagine, a couple of different times during the fall. I'll be at the Institute for Professionals of Taxation meeting, which I think, you know, that one's not necessarily open to the public, but I'll be speaking in Indian Wells, California on the 1st of October with some other great folks from the sales tax world about this case. I'm speaking with the New England State and Local Tax Group in the Boston area in mid-November, and next March, to be way out there, I'll be in New Orleans for a discussion about this in an ABA IPT venue that they're sponsoring there in New Orleans. So hopefully by then we'll have some greater level of understanding about where states are going.
Actually, if you're interested, we'd love to have you do one for the California Bar. So,
well, that sounds great. Why don't we talk about that?
We'll talk about that offline. But I just want to thank you again. It's always been fun, and I love to highlight the little firm that could from Lewiston. And so, just a reminder, we will have an archive show next week, but the week after, we're going to have a special show commemorating the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, and we'll be talking to someone from the World War I Museum in Kansas City, and who knows, maybe we'll do it live from Kansas City. I haven't quite decided that yet, but have a great week, everyone, and for those in the Carolinas, be safe. One word of advice, learn what those flags mean. the warning flags on the beach. I was in North Carolina after Hurricane Bob, and I remember coming out of the water and asking someone what the flag meant, and he told me it said, don't swim. So it's better to know that beforehand. So any event, everyone be safe, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks again, Matt. Have a great week, everyone. Follow us at Cyberlaw Radio on Twitter, and check out Internet Law Center at internetlawcenter.net. We're a full-service internet firm. Have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.